Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Minimum wage workers in roughly 20 states started the new year with a raise. Meanwhile, in New Hampshire and about 20 other states, the rate remains the same as the federal level of $7.25 an hour. Opponents of raising it here have long argued that salary decisions should be up to the employer, not the government, and that very few workers make the minimum to begin with. They also say that if the minimum's too high, companies will cut employee hours and eliminate jobs. Still, the pressure to raise New Hampshire's rate will be strong this year, with Democrats running the show at the legislature and all other New England states paying significantly more. Today in The Exchange, another round in the Granite State's minimum wage debate. And let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have two New Hampshire guests with us, but we begin with a look at the New England landscape. And with us for that is John Dankosky. He's host of Next New England, a weekly radio show and podcast about New England, based at WNPR in Hartford and heard here on NHPR Fridays at 3. And John, welcome back. It's really great to have you.
Oh, so good to be here, Laura. Thanks.
So just start out with the numbers, please. What's the minimum wage in the other five New England states as of the first of this year?
Yeah, well, the state that is closest to New Hampshire's in minimum is my home state of Connecticut, where it's at $10.10 an hour, and it has been for a few years. Rhode Island's just went up to $10.50 at the start of last year. Vermont's just went up a few cents to a strange number we'll get to in a moment, $10.78. Maine turned it up to $11, and Massachusetts is now at $12, but that'll be growing each year for a couple years.
Wow, so significantly higher than New Hampshire. And you seem to hint to this, John, but I'll ask you, sounds like there are raises in the works for some of these states.
Yeah, several states already have raises built in. The big one is in Massachusetts. In last year's legislative session, the state passed a law to increase the minimum to $15 over 5 years. So it's going to increase steadily until January of 2023 when it reaches that $15 mark. Now, Vermont's is tied to the Consumer Price Index, and that's why you see that strange number of 1078. In law, however, it can't decrease. So it can go up a little bit with the CPI, but it can't go down. Maine's is going to jump twice. It's another dollar next year, up to $12, and then it's tied to the CPI after that. I will say, though, Laura, just with some new governors coming in, some new legislatures coming in, there's a chance that we'll see more changes in the future. Connecticut's incoming Governor Ned Lamont, in his inauguration speech, said that he would be pushing for a $15 minimum, and he has a bigger Democratic majority in both houses to work with. In Vermont, Phil Scott has already vetoed bills that would have taken a leap in that state, too. But now, as of the beginning of this year, he's dealing with a stronger Democratic majority in Vermont. And that means there's a lot of talk about a $15 an hour wage coming up again this session, and that Republican governor might not have the ability to veto it again.
Well, that's interesting. So talking about how these wage increases get done, how is it typically happening here in New England, John? Is it usually the legislature or is it usually voter referendum?
It's mostly the legislature. Lawmakers in most states have passed the minimum wage laws. There was a ballot measure proposed for Massachusetts, but the legislature ended up passing their big increase that I talked about. In Maine, however, the increase was approved by voters, and it was over the objection of some lawmakers and also the objection, the strong objection, of former Governor Paul LePage. He led an effort to change the law that voters approved and actually slow down the rates. But his law, his proposal, didn't pass. So voters in Maine eventually got what they wanted, what they voted for.
Well, and in these higher paying states, you said $12 in Massachusetts, John, and $11 in Maine. How are employers feeling about these increasing costs?
I think it's pretty typical, Laura, and probably what you're going to hear a lot in your New Hampshire conversation today. People in the business community seem to say, and through their lobby groups and individually, when they go to the state house, they say that a higher minimum wage is going to kill their business. It's going to force them to lay off workers. Both sides in the issue trot out think tank reports to back their claims. Here in Connecticut, the Yankee Institute is warning of the possible loss of thousands of jobs if the state raises the wage to $15. And they're basing that on some studies that looked at what would happen in New Jersey, which has proposed something similar. That institute is pushing a different way to help low-income workers that would expand the earned income tax credit instead of forcing a minimum wage. Now, in Maine, for instance, a state that's already raised the minimum a few times in the last few years, and as I said, more raises are on the horizon there, that state has seen a historically high overall wage growth the last few years, and also no stunting of the overall growth of jobs. The study that I'm citing here is from the Maine Center for Economic Policy. So they're saying it's been good news in Maine economically, both for workers in their wages and also for the number of jobs. But they are quick to point out that it's really hard to isolate numbers. Whenever you hear these think tank studies, you can't say, well, the minimum wage went up or it went down, and that caused all of this economic chaos or flourishing. There's an awful lot of other factors, including the growth of the U.S. economy. So that's the sort of thing we always have to look for. I will say one other thing, Laura. In Vermont, we hear from an awful lot of people who just have a very historically different view of life than New Hampshire. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. And they know that it's a high-wage state. It's an expensive state. And they feel, I think, that they need to provide a higher wage for their citizens to compete with what's happening across the river in New Hampshire.
Well, and it's interesting. And we will have an economic writer joining us a little bit later in the show, because there is some emerging research now on this based on what happened in Seattle, which kind of took the lead. So that'll be coming up a little bit later in the hour. I won't ask you about that, John, but you did give us those dollar numbers earlier. Again, 12 in Massachusetts, 11 in Maine, you know, $10 and change elsewhere in New England. And the difference is pretty striking between the five other states in the region and our own $7.25 an hour here in New Hampshire. How is this viewed by political leaders, economic leaders in other states?
New Hampshire's always seen, I think, as an outlier amongst the other New England states for all the reasons that you cite. It has to do with tax policy. It has to do with just political culture. Massachusetts and Vermont are never going to try to compete with that. I think one thing, though, to keep an eye on with all of these small states clustered together is that when you see a change of any sort in one state, it's likely to follow in other states. An awful lot of legislatures are very reticent to pass big changes in policy, specifically tax policy or wage policy, unless they know their neighbors are going to come along. But if you see New York, Massachusetts, Vermont all of a sudden changing, you start to see, for instance, marijuana legalization in different states. There's pressure put on other states. So the question for New Hampshire is going to be whether or not it comes to wage law or legalization of pot, is it going to be isolated with all of these other states ringing around it that are going with very, very different sorts of policies? It's going to be interesting to see what happens in the next couple of years.
Well, sure. And as the host of a New England-based show, again, heard here on NHPR, Fridays at 3, and of course online as well, what states are you going to be watching this year, John, in terms of this minimum wage debate?
I think the two big ones are Connecticut and Vermont. In Vermont, as I said, Phil Scott, the Republican governor, going into his next term with a supermajority of he's a Republican governor with a Democratic supermajority, meaning that he's going to not be able to veto bills that come across his desk quite as easily. I think there's going to be a little bit of tension there about people wanting to raise the wage, maybe not even to $15 right away, but over time in that governor. And the new governor of Connecticut, Ned Lamont, has said that he wants to raise the wage to $15, although he didn't exactly run on it. He ran a campaign that was trying to be a little bit more fiscally conservative because we have gigantic budget deficits here in the state. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not he can get on the same page as other Democrats in the legislature to push through something while we're dealing with all of these other problems with the budget. Maybe that's not going to be a top priority as we try to fill a billion-dollar hole in the budget this year.
All right. Always good to hear what's happening around the region. John, thank you so much.
No problem, Laura. Thanks.
That's John Dankosky, again, host of Next New England, a weekly radio show and podcast, heard Fridays on NHPR at 3 o'clock. And our guest for the hour, as we look again at New Hampshire's minimum wage debate, are Bruce Berkey, New Hampshire State Director of the National Federation of Independent Business. And Bruce, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Dan Feltes, Democratic State Senator from Concord and co-sponsor of a bill to raise the minimum wage here in the state. And Senator Feltes, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Good to be here.
So, Senator Feltes, how high do you think New Hampshire's minimum wage should be?
Well, first and foremost, costs are rising in New Hampshire. People are finding it harder and harder to get ahead and stay ahead, whether it's housing, prescription drugs, the cost of affordable child care, to even a gallon of milk. And people need help. People are working harder and harder for less and less, in many cases working hard and living in poverty, which is where we're at right now. So what we need is a wage policy that reflects the current conditions on the ground. Senator Susie has a bill in to increase it to $10 next year, but also $12 by 2022, and that's linked to paid sick days. So in other words, if you provide at least 10 paid sick days, the minimum wage is $11, but if you don't provide at least 10 paid sick days, the minimum wage is $12 in 2022. That reflects what's going on in working families' lives.
And there are other bills, as I understand, in the House. There's a bunch of bills, some of them 10, some of them 12, some of them as high as 15, right, Senator Feltes?
That's true. And, you know, again, I think the debate is costs are rising. How do we best reflect what's going on in the economy to help working families get ahead and stay ahead and to help address some of the concerns of the small business community? It's a balance. But right now, the state of New Hampshire, we are an outlier in the sense that we have ceded all our authority here to the federal government. That's not the New Hampshire way. We do not even have in state law our own New Hampshire-based minimum wage.
Right, we're tied to the federal minimum.
We're directly tied to the federal government. That's not how we do things in New Hampshire. And when you look at it just more globally, Laura, you look at the situation where people are working hard and living in poverty. They're getting some assistance, whether it's food stamps or otherwise. Even though they're working multiple jobs, taxpayers shouldn't be subsidizing the private sector for people who are working hard.
That's an argument that often comes up in terms of, you know, who's responsible and so forth. I want to get you in too, Bruce Berkey. How high do you think the minimum wage should be here in New Hampshire?
Well, the minimum wage is at $7.25 an hour. And to be frank, Laura, it's very, very rare today that that rate is being paid. It's the free market that, and in this current economic market, it is clear that the minimum wage is probably closer to $10.
What people actually are paid.
The effective minimum wage, what people are being paid to start new jobs. And to have an artificial floor or a mandate put in is a little frustrating for the small business owner, and because they are addressing issues within their businesses, whether it's rates of pay, time off, hours, how many people to hire next, whether to grow, whether to retrench. These are issues that, you know, they need to be making and not making with artificial thresholds.
2,000 people, we were told, make the minimum wage here in New Hampshire, and another 6,000 make less than the minimum. I think those would be tipped employees. So
correct.
Not a lot of people, Senator Feltes, are even making the minimum here in New Hampshire. What do you think, that the free market is responding to these concerns and that the government doesn't need to?
Oh, thank you, Laura. Well, that's 8,000 right there. 8,000 people, and not just, you know, those are workers, those are kids that are relying upon their parents in many cases. So you're talking about potentially, you know, thousands of households of people who are working hard but living in poverty. That's a moral issue, but that's also an economic issue. It's an economic issue in terms of helping have more money in people's pockets. When there's more money in people's pockets, people spend it, and they spend it predominantly locally in that end of the wage sector. So when we talk about helping the economy, when we talk about an economy that works for everyone, not just those at the top, we talk about wages going up to reflect the costs are going up as well, because with costs going up, And people having more money in their pocket, they spend it, and they spend it right here in New Hampshire, and that helps New Hampshire small businesses.
So, Senator Feltes, you've talked a lot already about costs, and certainly, you know, we all pay those costs for sure. So let's talk about the cost of living. And both of you, but Bruce, you first, what do we know about minimum wage increases and their impact on overall inflation? For example, if the minimum is increased, do the wages of everybody else need to go up along the pay scale, thereby raising inflation as well? What do you know about this, Bruce Berkey?
I'll get to that in just a moment, Laura, but I'd just like to step back and address the issue of those who are making minimum wage today. And it is closer to $1,400 rather than $2,000 from the numbers I've looked at anyways. But, I mean, there are numbers everywhere. And of those, and the others that were mentioned, the 6,000, those people are making tips. And those people, by law, have to at least make a minimum wage, and the employers make that
up. The tipped wage, yeah.
But that is a very rare instance. People are generally making $12 and $13 and $14 and sometimes $24 an hour as a tipped employee. So it's important to know that those people are receiving a decent wage. And second, most of those 1,400 probably who are minimum wage employees, they're first-time jobs. They're part-time jobs. They're not designed for supporting a family. That's not what is taking place in the communities.
So you think those 1,400 or 2,000, depending on which numbers, are more like teenagers working at McDonald's, trying to make a little pocket money? Is that what you're saying, Bruce?
Exactly.
Go ahead, Senator Feltes, and then I do want to talk about inflationary impacts. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, sure. I mean, certainly there are, teenagers who are working at McDonald's and those kind of things. But the overarching myth that this is just teenagers and that these are not jobs that people are supporting a family on is incorrect. And, just based on conversation with constituents, but also my prior life as a legal aid lawyer working with low-income families, these are some cases the jobs that some folks are only jobs that they can get, and sometimes they're cobbling together multiple part-time jobs, working hard to support their family. Again, at the end of the day, here in the Granite State, we support hard work, and there's so many people, thousands, that are working hard and living in poverty. That's not right. That's not fair. And it's not good for our economy either.
Let's talk about inflation a little bit. And Bruce, to you first, but Senator Feltes, definitely want to hear from you too. So there's long been an argument that if you raise the minimum wage, everybody else's wages need to go up, and then the costs are passed on through to consumers. So, for example, if Joe's sandwich shop, starts paying everybody $9, $10, $11 an hour, Joe has to raise the price of his sandwiches, and the inflation goes up, and it's to the point, some people say, that it's to the point where the help you would get from a higher minimum wage would be negated by those higher sandwich costs. I know I'm oversimplifying, but I wonder what you think, Bruce Berkey.
Well, in the business community, we call that wage compression. And what you find is, the rate is $7.25 today. The effective rate might be at a local ski area, it might be $8.50 or $9. And so if it's raised to $12, then that person who was making $12 at that ski area and the parking lot attendant who had been at $8.50 is now making $12, then the person who had been making $12 before the increase is going to say,
I want $13.
Or $14 or $15. And all the way up the line, that's going to have an impact on that business's operating costs. And so you have that compression. Then businesses begin to look, should I cut back on hours? Should I cut back on positions? How can I do things differently so that I'm not paying more money?
Well, and there's been a lot of research about the employment effects and the salary effects. But Senator Feltes, I'm going to let you chime in on the inflationary effects after a short break, and we'll also bring in our listeners. Our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Coming up also, we'll bring in an economics writer who's looked a lot at the research. And again, we'll start hearing from you, so you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment.
New Hampshire Public Radio listeners are educated, engaged, and digitally savvy. As an NHPR underwriter, your business can reach this digital audience through our many podcasts, our e-newsletters, or at our award-winning news site, nhpr.org. Learn how you can reach the best and brightest online community in New Hampshire and beyond by visiting the business support page at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, should New Hampshire raise its minimum wage? If so, by how much? If not, why not? Let us know what you think. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Dan Feltes, Democratic State Senator from Concord, co-sponsor of a bill to raise the wage here in the state. Also with us, Bruce Berkey, New Hampshire State Director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. And before we go to our listeners, Senator Feltes, I did want to give you a chance to respond to what we were talking about just before the break. The concern that if you start raising the minimum wage, everybody else's wages get bumped up, those costs get passed on to the business, and the business passes those costs on to consumers. And in the end, you're just paying even more with that higher paycheck.
Well, I think that may have been a legitimate concern approximately 10 years ago if we kept on raising the wage, but it's been stuck at $7.25. In fact, as we'd mentioned earlier, we don't even have one in the state of New Hampshire. We've ceded all minimum wage authority to the federal government. That's not the New Hampshire way. That's not how we operate. We do things the unique New Hampshire way, which is including a number of pieces of legislation that are up for debate and discussion. I think thoughtful, reasonable pieces of legislation that balance interests of the business community, balance interests of working families, including Senate President has a bill to increase to go to 10 next year and then $12 an hour by 2022. If you offer less than 10 paid sick days, if you offer 10 or more paid sick days, the minimum wage is $11 an hour. And paid sick days is part of the puzzle for working families, including when you may have a kid who may be sick and you have to abruptly stay home with him or her. Not having access to paid sick days disproportionately affects women, disproportionately affects low-wage families, particularly here in the state of New Hampshire. It is a big impediment for working families getting ahead and staying ahead. So we got to recognize the whole puzzle here, which is costs are rising for working families, and we haven't kept pace in terms of wages the way that we could and the way that we should, in a way that, quite frankly, with more money in people's pockets, that means more money spent in the local economy right here in the state of New Hampshire.
Well, I guess my question, Senator Feltes, is would costs rise even more if the minimum wage were hiked up by, you know, $2, $3, $4? Is there a point where the inflationary effects start to outweigh the benefits of the increase?
Well, there's plenty of research in this, and this is my understanding of the research, and you'll have a researcher on, but my understanding of the research is that if you do it in a thoughtful, reasonable way, those kind of effects are mitigated. And I think the legislation being contemplated in the legislature right now balances all those interests pretty well, and obviously there'll be a debate and discussion about it. And
sure, because you've got your bills in the Senate, and they've got their bills in the House, and so forth.
And people will continue to have conversations and discuss these important public policy approaches. But look, at the end of the day, we can't be stuck at $7.25 an hour ceding our authority to the federal government. And we can't be continually in a situation where taxpayers, Laura, are subsidizing the private sector, because people are working full time, working hard, and they're living in poverty and they're getting assistance. That's not fair to them. That's not fair to taxpayers. And you know what? It's time to raise the wage. It's time to reflect the actual conditions on the ground.
And that's a point that I do want to sort of pull out with all of you in just a moment, the idea about public assistance and minimum wage workers. But both of you, let's go to our listeners. Lots of people who want to jump into our conversation. Jay joins us from Dover. Hi, Jay. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment on a couple of things, more of a feedback really than anything, or I'd be very curious to hear your panel's feedback. I'm a small business owner myself. I live in Dover with my wife and three kids, and I operate my business out of Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And I wanted to get comments on the fact that that we've really had this discussion a few times. I think you on the Exchange have had this discussion a few times about wage compression and employees getting paid a minimum wage and such. But I wonder if the conversation, if it would be helpful, and I'd be curious to hear your panel's response to this. where being a small business owner, I wonder if we as the business community should be pivoting the discussion instead of viewing employees as a cost to viewing them as an investment. And I think as that fundamental shift comes in, I mean, in my small business, I can't function without my staff. My team is the best team on the planet. And I really wonder if the conversation around viewing them simply as overhead, as an effect on the bottom line, really should change. If we view them as an investment, and we as the owners in the small business community really thought outside the box collaboratively how we could view ways to serve our employees and really come underneath them and build them up.
Wow, Jay. Yeah. It's really lovely to hear you say that you have the best team on the planet. That's great. And what do you think? You're a small business representative, Bruce Berkey, again, state director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses.
Well, I'm also a small business owner, Laura, and I think I have a great team too, Jay. But Jay, you raise a fantastic point, an excellent point about investing in your workforce, because that's your bread and butter. That's the sweet spot for making your business go, making it successful. And business owners across the state of New Hampshire are, I think, doing that every day. They have to make sure that their employees are, you know, happy or relatively happy. They can't be perfectly happy, but and producing and doing a good job in their respective fields.
So don't just look at it as a cost. Look at it as
an
investment.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It has to be an investment. And you know, and that's especially small business owners, because they have less flexibility than some of the larger businesses in the state. And this session in the legislature, there are a lot of different measures being introduced that would have negative financial impacts on the operations of a business. And so, you know, the minimum wage isolated and talked about, you know, that's one thing. And maybe there can be some agreements found. I know Representative Moffitt in his bill has a training wage proposed, and that's something that the small business community is supportive of. When we're talking minimum wage. But when you're also talking, you know, impacts to tip wages, increasing that minimum wage rate, taking away 3% commissions for rooms and meals tax, predictive scheduling, tax increases on the business enterprise tax especially. That's the biggest component for the small business community. That's on the House side, so I won't blame Senator Felton for that.
So but lots of concerns bubbling around for small businesses
in
the legislature.
That's what makes, you know, some of these discussions hard to have.
Well, right, and now Jay talks about, you know, having a really great team, and that really is inherent to a business success. We heard earlier, Bruce, from John Dankosky, who gave us numbers showing large disparities in the minimum wage here in New England. How much does that become a competitive disadvantage for New Hampshire? Will potential workers, and we know, you know, we need workers here in New Hampshire, look at the Granite State and go, you know, I think I'll stay in Maine where I can make a lot more money?
Well, I think I would argue the reverse. If you look at the economic numbers, we have the highest number of people ever working in the state of New Hampshire. We have the lowest unemployment, I know, in New England, perhaps the Northeast. And there are 15,000 jobs right now being advertised with higher paying wages in the state of New Hampshire, higher than minimum wage. So the economic opportunity that this state has created in this current environment is strong.
Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. We're looking once again at New Hampshire's minimum wage debate. There are lots of bills in the legislature to raise the minimum. Meanwhile, around the country, about 20 states have raised their minimums this year. About 20, give or take, still have the same minimum wage as the federal government, $7.25 an hour. That includes New Hampshire. We're looking once again at this debate in this newer landscape. And you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And both of you, I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Allison Schrager is with us by phone. She's a writer and columnist with Quartz, a New York-based business and economic news site. By the way, Allison's new column called Tipping Points launches on Wednesday this week. Allison, it's really nice to have you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've been writing a ton about this, Allison, and it's really interesting. I want to ask you about your recent work looking at studies of Seattle, which led the way on these increases in 2014 from $9.47 an hour to $13 in January 2016. What are researchers finding about Seattle, Allison?
Well, it's been a bit of a mixed bag. They found that while, you know, you didn't have job losses like some people feared you might, you did find that there was a reduction in worker hours, and also that certain kinds of there's higher skilled and lower skilled people, and most people earn a low wage or lower skilled. But even within that group, there are disparities. They found that older workers who were receiving the minimum wage, who maybe had a few more skills, were more likely to stay employed, as opposed to college students or people getting their first jobs. It was a slowed hiring for them, so it's harder to get your first foot on that rung of the economic ladder. But it did increase pay for certain kinds of minimum wage workers.
So it was a mixed bag. The sort of unskilled workers, Allison, the sort of first entrants, ended up doing worse, but the minimum wage workers with slightly more experience, more time on the job, did better.
Exactly.
Senator Feltus, what are your thoughts on this, that in Seattle, it was, as Allison tells us, a mixed bag, didn't help everybody?
Well, I haven't researched it the way Allison has, but I will say this. I think in Seattle, it bumped up pretty quick. I think the proposals in the legislature are thoughtful, reasonable increases. And I think my review of the research is that, abrupt, dramatic jumps may have more of a disruptive impact. And so I think more thoughtful, reasonable increases, the way that the democratically sponsored bills in the legislature right now approach it, I think make good sense. And so I think it mitigates against some of the concerns that have been raised in some of the research. And certainly that's something that we've heard, and that's what we've taken into account as we crafted these proposals. And again, not doing it all at once, not jumping too far, too fast, going in a reasonable, thoughtful way, receiving the input from the business community, receiving the input from working families across the state who are seeing costs rise, seeing the absence of paid sick days, seeing the absence of other really important measures that are competitive related, including paid family and medical leave insurance, so important, especially with Massachusetts going forward with
it. Which is another show that we'll do later, Senator Feltus, for sure. And you were nodding, Bruce Berkey, while Senator Feltus was saying, look, we're not jumping in all at once. We're doing it in a sort of measured way. What do you think?
Well, it certainly, I think I'll agree with Senator Feltus. We have history on this morning's show. I think the folks over in the Senate and the House, they do reach out to the business community. They do talk with us. They do take our input, and we appreciate that very, very much. I think it's just important that we continue those conversations because, obviously the minimum wage will eventually go up someday, whether it's 2019, 2020, 2021, it's going to go up. But doing it the right way is important. And, looking at a training wage, we think that's a great idea. I think we Senator Feltus and I spoke briefly about it last week. Again, Representative Moffitt, thank you. But there's another bill in that's being heard on Wednesday that has a $2 differential increase per hour for nighttime work. And generally, that's already built into the equation, built into the pie, that rate of pay for somebody who's working between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. But now you're seeing, another effort that increases.
Let's take another call. Thank you for that one. And Wesley calls in from Wolfboro. Hi, Wesley. Go ahead. You're in the air. Oh, Wesley, we lost you. I hope you call back, Wesley. Our number is 1-800-892-6477.
I'll take that question.
Yeah, that's an easy question, Senator Feltus. Allison, back to you. You wrote, as we heard earlier, about the Seattle experiment and lots of research around that. But you also wrote recently, Allison, that while many of these minimum wage increases have come in from more liberal-leaning coastal states, if I could put it that way, you talked recently about the minimum wage increases in Missouri and Arkansas, decidedly not liberal, decidedly not coastal. You called these increases in these two states, Allison, a bold experiment. How come?
Well, similar to Seattle, they were large. They were sudden. And, when you look at a minimum wage increase, you have to look in the context of the broader economy. So while Seattle had a booming economy, so maybe they could, you know, afford some experimentation, Arkansas and Missouri don't have very strong economies. So they're increasing their minimum wages to about 70% of their median hourly wage, which is very aggressive. Even liberal economists think it should be about 50%. So that's why, you know, it was sort of surprising that they went that way and made such a large, dramatic increase that was also quite large relative to their economy.
That's interesting. So when states consider raising the minimum, Allison, economists say they should take into account the median wage in the state overall?
Yes, because that gives you a sense of what people are already being paid. So, you know, minimum wage workers tend to, you know, be inexperienced or low, have less skills. So, you know, you can't expect to pay them what you would pay sort of the average worker. And so when you increase your minimum wage to 80% of median pay, then that's going to be a lot harder on businesses and you're going to expect more adverse effects.
I see. So you don't want to go too far outside the norm or it gets disruptive. And it sounds like from what you said, Allison, in Missouri and Arkansas, you know, paying 70% of the median wage, it's great for those workers, but economists say it might be going too far.
Yeah, because what you're doing is then having to pay people well above like what you're paying, or sort of within the range of what you're paying more skilled workers who sort of, you know, arguably add more value. So that's why most, even said economists agree, it shouldn't be well beyond 50%.
Senator Feltes, how much are Democrats looking at the components here in terms of raising the minimum wage? I mean, are they picking a number because that seems to be the hot number now among Democratic Party circles? Or are they picking a number based on, okay, what's the cost of living? What's the median wage here in New Hampshire? You know, let's crunch this economically.
Well, I think, you know, it reflects a lot of what we talked about already, obviously. And so in terms of the research, maybe going too far too fast, that's factored into conversation. Input from the small business community is factored into the conversation, as well as input from working families who are seeing costs rise and rise and rise. And so where we ultimately arrive, again, I co-sponsored two bills, Representative Moffitt's and the Senate President's. Senate President's, I think, has a unique, innovative approach where we tie the wage also to paid sick days, which is a big impact on working families, especially working families with children. That's a really important component. And so where ultimately this debate evolves, really looking forward to it. It's a really important debate. It's time to finally do something after over a decade of not doing something. And on top of that, I think we need to be open-minded, everybody. I recently did hear, I think, Governor Sununu indicate that he's fine with where things are at right now. We're not fine. $7.25 an hour and ceding our authority to the federal government, we're not fine with that. So hopefully Governor Sununu will be open to the conversation as it moves forward and we can work together to finally raise the wage.
Well, and it seems like with Democrats running the House and the Senate that we will have some sort of a minimum wage increase coming out of the legislature. So then it'll be on his desk and he'll have to decide. We're hearing from a lot of our listeners. Here's a comment from Cheryl on Facebook who says, "While I am all for raising the minimum wage, it would not be fair for someone working at an entry-level job that does not require certification to be making the same or more than someone like me who is working at a professional job. Cheryl says, I am certified and have undergone extensive training for the job I have and feel I deserve what I make. Raising the wage to $10 to $12 an hour, Cheryl says, would be a good starting point." Cheryl, thank you for jumping in on that. We'll hear from a lot more listeners after a very short break. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or respond on Facebook like Cheryl did. It's NHPR Exchange. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, our Sky Crew lands in our studio with all the news from the world of astronomy. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, we're looking at the minimum wage in New Hampshire. Several bills in the legislature would raise it above the current level of $7.25 an hour. We've been looking at this and all the activity around the minimum wage in other states, including here in New England. We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Allison Schrager. She's a writer and columnist with Quartz, a New York-based business and economic news site. She's been focusing a lot on the minimum wage. With me in studio, Dan Feltes, Democratic State Senator from Concord, and Bruce Berkey, New Hampshire State Director with the National Federation of Independent Businesses. And all of you, right back to our listeners. Steve is joining us from Holderness. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Welcome.
Great. Thanks, Laura. What a great show today. It's
good.
Something that's, as a small business owner, is on my mind. As you see the activity take place around us in other states and around the country. And I really appreciate you pushing the questions. I have a small business here in Holderness. I do have 24 employees. Half of them are college students from Plymouth State. I do have two 15-year-olds that work for me. And the question that I have, first of all, let me state that the starting wage, even for the college students, in order to get a college student to come to work and to punch in, and my job is primarily piecework, is $10 an hour. There's nobody in my company, not even the 15-year-olds, that make the minimum wage. And so we're at $10 an hour right now. And the question that I would have is has there ever been an application of this minimum wage concept of $15 an hour with any kind of an exception for a 15-year-old who's living at home with mom and dad with college students who are going to school? I mean, I actually pay more now than the college does themselves in order to attract these students. But it's just, I'm at a threshold where if I was to have to take and go to even $12 an hour, which would raise the per unit cost of the piece, that it would be less expensive for me to automate or outsource to somebody who is automating and not have any of these employees at all. And I want to comment that you've been right in pushing that it is going to increase inflation, costs of goods, costs of everything. It's simple economics states that if you introduce more money into an economy, that inflation is going to follow. If you take a worker who's making $8 an hour and you now pay them $15 an hour, that their spending value is high, but the cost of what they have to buy is going to increase as well. And I don't have all these studies, but
yeah,
you gotta believe that it's going to be more than what they're paying even today.
Well, Steve, it's really good to hear from you, given your personal experience and lots of questions from what you said for our guests. First of all, Bruce Berkey, the idea of a training wage, he says, look, nobody is making less than $10 an hour as a starting wage, but what about a training wage? I know that's something you're in favor of. Can you just explain what that is?
Yeah, I think Steve was almost describing it himself. He was doing a nice job with it. I know Representative Moffitt's bill has one built in, whereby if the minimum wage was moved up to, say, $9, you could take a 16 or 17-year-old under Representative Moffitt's bill and pay that individual maybe eight. I don't know if I have the numbers correct, but pay him or her $8.25 for 3 months, and then at the conclusion of those 3 months, increase that person to $9 per hour. And so it would be an investment by the employee. It would be an investment by the employer. And at the end of 3 months, they see if the investment works well.
And one would hope that the employer wouldn't use that as an opportunity to fire the person. They probably wouldn't because they just invested all that time in training. But
Correct.
But that might be a concern.
And so the state of Pennsylvania has a law like this in place. And they allow it to go up to 20 years old and for 6 months. So, different age groups, different amounts of time, depending on the state.
Well, it's so interesting to hear from you, Steve. And Allison, I want to throw this to you. He says, look, $10 an hour, fine, I can pay it. But if I had to go up to 12, I couldn't afford it. I would have to automate, meaning fewer jobs. And I just wonder what research you've seen, Allison, concerning the inflationary effects of a higher minimum wage.
Well, I mean, these big minimum wage increases have been relatively new. So in the past, they weren't that large, so you wouldn't see a big inflationary impact.
Yeah, 50 cents here or there, sure.
Yeah, so we don't really know yet. But there is research that when the increases are big, you don't see people laying people off right away, but you do, some studies show if you have bigger increases, like what he's describing, if you see a decrease in hiring rates. So that might be true some of the time, but it is hard to know the inflationary effects because we've just never seen increases that are well above inflation before.
Yeah, that's what makes this so interesting, is that we are seeing these bigger increases and we're seeing them in a lot of states. You've talked about this before, but I'd love to just give you a quick opportunity to jump in, Senator Feltes. How do you respond to Steve's real concern that if it goes up to 12, he's not going to be able to keep as many workers as he has now?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm not sure that's exactly what he said, but I would like to have a conversation with Steve further about that. But the upshot is this, is that is a concern, obviously. We've reflected that concern, I think, working on these different pieces of legislation, thoughtful, reasonable increases, as we've talked about. If you jump too far, too fast, that has a distinct impact, I think, based on the research, as Allison has noted and others have noted. And the legislation that we've put forward, either Senator Susie's bill, Representative Moffitt's bill, and there's other, I think, reasonable proposals in the legislature, are thoughtful, reasonable approaches where it's not jumping far and fast in a way that's going to have the kind of detrimental impacts, I think, that people fear. At the end of the day, we have a system right now where we punt to the federal government. Federal government dictates to us what our minimum wage is. That's not how we traditionally do things in New Hampshire.
And that was our choice. We did that, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, or 8 years ago. The decision was made to get rid of the state minimum and tie it, 2011, and tie it to the federal government.
And I think, you know.
So it's not like they're dictating to us, like we chose to have them dictate to
us. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's not the way we do things, and we need to change it. And time's right now to raise the wage and make sure that we reflect the what's going on the ground for working families, which is that costs are rising. In many cases, they're finding it harder and harder to get ahead and stay ahead. And we need to make sure that people in New Hampshire have more money in their pockets when they spend it right here in New Hampshire.
Well, and Elizabeth has a comment about costs are rising. On Facebook, she says, rents are soaring, raise the minimum. So that's from Elizabeth. On Facebook, Stacy on Facebook says retail and hospitality are where most low-paying jobs are. New Hampshire continues to build more restaurant and retail locations, although we don't have that many workers working at minimum wage. There are thousands, she says, that work between $9 and $11 an hour. Housing, food, energy costs continue to climb. Stacy says research shows that increases in minimum wages do not affect most businesses like they say they do. Some business owners are making a living off the backs of their employees who are not making a living. Stacy, thank you for that comment. And Bruce Berkey, what do you think, especially in the retail and hospitality sector that Stacy raises?
Well, in the retail community, I don't have as much experience as, say, Curtis Berry does, Curtis being a lobbyist for the New Hampshire Retail Merchants Association. But certainly within the lodging and restaurant industry, the tipped wage employee is in general, doing pretty well here in New Hampshire. That's been the information that I've reviewed relative to that type of employee. So I think that, we have turned to more of a service economy, and that does make it a little more difficult in this state because you don't have the strong manufacturing base that we used to have back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. It's eroding on an annual basis.
I want to ask all of you about the phenomenon we've heard a lot about recently, and I'll turn to you first, Allison. Sudden large increases at places like Amazon, Target, Walmart, I think Target and Amazon now, correct me if I'm wrong, Allison, are paying $15 an hour. What are the impacts of those big increases by big employers on smaller businesses, some of those, restaurants that Bruce Berkey talks about? What do you know about that, Allison?
Well, it does, they all are competing for workers. So obviously it puts them at smaller workers at a disadvantage. Also, small businesses especially in the service and retail sector, tend to have very small margins. Opposed to Amazon, obviously makes much bigger profits. So, they can afford to pay more, but it does make it harder for small businesses to compete.
So how are they doing it, Allison? Are they, you know, trying to offer friendlier workplaces or, you know, sort of a hometown feeling? I just wonder how, you know, how a mom and pop on Main Street here in Concord competes with, you know, Target a couple miles away.
Well, they have a hard time competing on every way, and that's why we're probably seeing a lot fewer mom and pops and seeing more Targets.
Sure.
That's one of the reasons we're saying more concentration of employers. And it's not just for workers, it's also for prices and on every level.
What do you think about that, Bruce Berkey?
Well, it's interesting, Laura. I don't have the studies in front of me, but I've read that there are studies out there that, you know, these minimum wage increases reduce upward mobility in situations for especially young workers. I'd be interested to know whether Allison's familiar with the studies that have taken place out between the states of Minnesota and Wisconsin, sort of like a river runs between them, sort of like Vermont and New Hampshire. But Minnesota raised their minimum wage by 33%, but they did it over a four-year period, which is, I think, similar to what Senator Feltes is talking about. But during that period, or at the conclusion of that four-year period, it showed that youth employment went down in Minnesota by about 9%, and next door in Wisconsin, it went up by about 10.5%. So it demonstrated that, you know, it was having a negative impact in Minnesota, those increases. And Wisconsin, their neighbor to the east, was the beneficiary.
Getting to those increases, again, that we've seen at Amazon, Walmart, Target, Senator Feltes, you know, one could look at that and say, hey, this kind of proves the point that the free market is taking care of this. We've heard from several small business owners who say nobody pays the minimum anyway. That's not entirely true. Numbers that we got from Department of Employment Security say about 2,000 grant stays make the minimum. But given that few workers make the minimum to begin with, that we are seeing these increases in the private sector, does that prove the point that the market's going to take care of it? We don't need to do it at the government level. I wonder what you think.
Well, I mean, in line with that also, what Mr. Berkey just talked about, I'm not familiar with the Minnesota-Wisconsin study. Be interested in reading it. But the upshot is all states surrounding New Hampshire are going up. So to the extent that there is validity in the cross-labor impact state to state, the reality is New Hampshire's on an island right now in terms of our minimum wage. And so if we're worried about the possibility of, you know, potentially losing workers or jobs or businesses based on that, yeah, I don't think that's a valid concern competitively regionally. I think the bigger concern competitively regionally is attracting and retaining the kind of workforce we need, the workforce of tomorrow. Part of that goes to workforce development, job training initiatives. Part of it goes to making sure that our employment policies both at a state level and in the private sector, working collaboratively together, make good sense, reflect the realities on the ground, the fact that costs are rising. Housing, childcare, prescription drugs, even a gallon of milk has gone up, as I know, as I have two, I have an 18-month-old who, you know, and so I'm very familiar that the costs are going up on so many essentials.
I have two teenagers. I'm familiar with the cost of milk for sure.
And so we have to reflect the reality of what's going on. And that's, we need to take the input from the business community. We need to take the input from working families who in many cases are taking it on the chin in so many ways, including property taxes, but are finding it harder and harder to get ahead and stay ahead. In many cases, working so hard, multiple part-time jobs in many cases, and living in poverty, Laura. That's not fair to them. It's not fair to our local economy either.
That raises something that I wanted to ask you about, Allison. A while back, during one of these minimum wage debates, and both my studio guests are right, we've talked about this many times before on The Exchange. But Allison, this came up in New Hampshire where supporters of raising the wage said, why should taxpayers subsidize companies that pay so little that their workers can't afford health care or food, instead having to go on Medicaid or food stamps? How salient is this argument now, Allison, with companies like Amazon, like Target, paying their workers a lot more? How much are you hearing this now?
Well, we hear it a lot, but I don't know if it's the right way to think about it. I mean, in economic theory, and I mean, you can argue whether or not this holds up, is workers are paid the value they bring to a company. And, you know, if a company has very small margins, then, you know, they're paying them their value, which is definitely true for smaller companies. So, but there, we can't say, argue that as a society, you know, a rich country, that we think that it's only right that people are paid a certain amount. You know, people should not be living in poverty. And that's a fair argument that we might decide with. But then we have to also decide, you know, who pays for that? If you're a small business owner and you can't afford to hire, pay someone more than a certain amount, and you know they only bring so much value to your company, then you could argue that we as taxpayers should provide that subsidy. So I've never quite, I don't think it's quite, you know, sort of a really silly argument for me to say, well, you know, we shouldn't all subsidize workers. I mean, that business owners, it depends. If a business owner is making an enormous profit and, you know, has all these workers who are barely getting by, that might be true. But if you have a business owner, especially a small business, has very small margins, and we're subsidizing their workers just because of society we believe people should have a certain living standard, then, you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
Bruce, I wonder what you think about this. Again, this came up a lot a couple years ago. I've heard it less here in New Hampshire now. But the argument that, you know, why should taxpayers make up the shortfall for minimum wage workers who, you know, can't afford their rent, so they get rent subsidies, or they can't afford food, so they get food stamps. Whose responsibility is it to see that working people have enough to live on?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm not familiar with the studies, and I'm not sure if there have been recent studies on that, but it's a fair question. Who's responsible for a living wage? I don't know that I don't think the minimum wage should be a living wage. I think that they are two very different things. I mean, when the minimum wage was first established back in the 1930s under FDR, it was a protection. It was not intended to be a living wage. So it's important to make that distinguishing point. But, you know, I think that employers, you know, want to make sure that they can maintain their employee base. And so they're going to tend to their employees' needs during the process and balance what they can afford and what they can pay out.
Well, I can't believe we've got the music rolling and we have so much more we could have
talked
about.
Hours.
We could go on for hours. I did want to let everybody know that we are having a panel of legislative leaders on the show on Wednesday. Two Democrats, two Republicans, two from the House, two from the Senate.
Sounds balanced.
And the minimum wage is sure to come up again. So we'll touch on it briefly again on Wednesday. But for now, I want to thank all of you for being with us. Allison, thank you for taking time out. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Allison Schrager. She's a writer and columnist with Quartz. And Bruce Berkey, Senator Feltes, thank you also for being here. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.